Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we're bringing you part one of a conversation with a painter, educator, and award-winning cartoonist whose books include Soldier's Heart, Late Bloomer, and The Ephemerata, Shaping the Exquisite Nature of Grief. She's taught both first graders and college students, and along with husband and fellow cartoonist Justin Green, she starred in the documentary Married to Comics. She's also the subject of an exhibition at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum in Columbus, Ohio, called Write It Down, Draw It Out, The Comics Art of Carol Tyler. Carol Tyler, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about The Ephemerata. This is a book about grief. Two books about grief, I should say.
Yes, there are two books. I don't know how to say this, because if I say it's all about grief, I am not an expert. I'm an artist and a writer. And I experienced something pretty profound after losing family members. And I didn't know how to articulate it. Because at that time, when I started this book 10 years ago, you could easily say that Kubler-Ross, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, had the formula that you could go to and go through your stages. But when you go through it, you actually see people, you see them go through the periods of death, and you witness that stuff. And wait a minute. That's my sister. That's not supposed to be happening to her. She's healthy. What? And so I thought, well, these people that died, some readers know about them because I've been writing about them for years. They've been the subjects of my comics. And I thought, but I don't want to do like Soldier's Heart Extended, you know, the book about my dad. I had a lot of family members and stuff. I didn't want to just have it be rolling through for more of that, because I had other concerns beyond telling the story of how they died. And so I started thinking about how to frame this, how to do it, or even to do it at all, because, you know, death is a very personal, private thing. So I had to sit with it for quite a while till I could figure out the language and decide how to go about it, because I can't assume that the reader automatically loves me, loves my family. First and foremost, I have to tell a story that can resonate with the experience of the reader. Mostly what I want to do is bring people through the experience of mourning.
Yes, and you talk about language. The subtitle of The Ephemerata is Shaping the Exquisite Nature of Grief. The word exquisite can be slippery. You know, I can't help but think of the surrealist art game, The Exquisite Corpse.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason why that word came so clearly was exquisite to me means like so beautiful, but yet loaded with the right kind of baggage that presses the places so that it's not an easy beauty. You look these things in the eye, watching the people and watching myself have to deal with it. It was so painful. It was so sad, but it was also, you know, you'd be in the room with somebody who was really suffering, go outside and it'd be this spectacular sunset and the birds would be making a pattern across the sky. And so that pain against that is what made it jump to exquisite, because everything that I experienced had that flip side element of balance, of like, maybe it's just that it meant intensity. With every recounting, because I kept notes, every encounter I had with the moments just brought out everything into much richer focus, much more intensity. And I understood and had images of everything that was going to lead me through and explain how I was feeling. And I understood that this place was called Griefville. And it was called that because one of the sage characters a fellow named Tooks, who's been there since forever. He thought you needed to add a little levity to the situation. This, it's hard to say, grief, Phil. So that was funny to him 400 years ago after the plague. Because I realized that the experience of death was throughout humanity, throughout time. And this guy was talking about centuries earlier, which placed the experience in the continuum of time, life, and death. I thought, this is a whole different big thing. And then when I realized that this artifact I had, which was my mom's, my great-grandmother's mourning bonnet from the 1800s, that was like a building. That was a structure in Greenfield that I could go into. I mean, I'd put the hat on. I found it in my mom's stuff before she died. She was like, oh, yeah, Dad said that was Grandma Theola's. Do you know she used to take care of Civil War soldiers? She was a healer. She healed everybody. So then that hat, because it belonged to a healer, became my place of refuge in Greenfield. The connecting with a real object, all the tools I needed, I had within. It would not be a matter of going to find a book somewhere. It was just up to me to just course through it as best I could. About a year later, I had a 6-foot table, and I found a bunch of extra illustration board, and I laid it out from end to end. And I had to put a little extra table there because it turned out to be an 8 feet that I needed, 24 inches by 8 feet. And I started on the upper left one end, and that map of this place and all of that stuff tumbled out, took all night. But I drew that entire map in one shot. The map of Greenfield that helped me figure out, oh, okay. Not only does this tell me about this place, it helps me understand the process of coming to it, the processes of death that people go through, and what my job is as a person who experiences this. And my job, I articulate very clearly in the second book.
You talk in the book about the long residency in Greenfield, and yes. The artwork for the ephemerata is intentionally monochrome. There are occasional muted splashes of color, but your work is normally full of vivid color, you know, summer days in the Midwest, plants and toys and fabric and intense moods. Yeah, so this was going back to your black and white roots.
Exactly what I wanted to do. I thought, well, you know, life and death is black and white. And you kind of get into a focus of some sort when you're dealing with grief. And I thought, what if I used black and white intentionally and really let the marks do all of the work that color normally does? And correct, I wanted to go back to my roots, but I also wanted to have that convey that mood of kind of a flat vibe, you know, colorless. But in book two, the color starts to kick up again because I start to come back into my life. I'm stuck in grief in that first book. I'm really dealing with it heavy. So the content in the ephemerata, the mood is somber, reflective, and piercingly focused at times. So I really felt like I could do that with the pen and ink. In an age of AI and auto-tune, this is drawn by somebody with a dip pen. That's what I wanted it to feel like.
You know, your art puts me in mind of a river. A lot of cartoonists lay out every page like a grid, but your pages are fluid and meandering. Even the lettering tracks across frames.
I tried to up my game with lettering in this book. I hope that comes through. A lot of people are losing connection to language because they don't read hand lettering is difficult for some people now. But I did try to allow text, or try to make text have an artistry all its own. It's part of the design, and you have to figure out how to make it have a certain particular presence, and it has to convey, it has a big job to do beyond just saying words and connecting words to make meaning. The words are going to say something to flow and get your mind to somewhere else, and the content, it'll either pull it or advance it so that the next time you see an image, you've been prepared because of the text and the image before. I'm very aware of panel to page, page to opposing page, previous page. So when you say it's like a river, all of that is planned to flow the reader through.
And grief itself is a bit like a river because, you know, sometimes it's deep, sometimes it's shallow. You know, sometimes it almost dries up completely.
Yeah. Yeah, just when you think, you know, hey, I've had a couple of days I haven't thought about so-and-so. Wham! Here comes a flood.
A flash flood.
A flash flood. The other night, I cried for 4 hours solid. It wasn't because I was suppressing anything. I mean, it wasn't just grief. It was frustration with our country and decisions that people make, and just kind of a malaise sense of like, what the heck's going on? But it was also about missing folks. And I just started crying, and it wasn't crying. It was heave sobbing. It was that level of crying. And I kept thinking, all right, pin it to this, make it be about that. It's like, no, I'm just crying. In the book, I talk about how I haven't been able to cry. And I did not cry for years. I could not cry. I've even stopped writing because words can slow down or make an assignment on thought that maybe doesn't need to be there. It makes it conform.
Well, I mean, you use visual metaphor a lot. You use allegory. Trees figure prominently throughout your book, The Ephemerata.
I was nervous about that because, you know, that could be a stereotype. Barbara Walters used to ask people that. What kind of tree are you? But it was a big thing for my mom, being stuck in the truck as my dad was driving all over the country with her and stuck there. Of course, she was looking out the window, deciding her life and thinking about things with trees all around. So I did use them as a symbol of life and the strength and the presence that a person has on this earth. You are connected, and your spirit is up here in the leaf area, you know.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today, we're bringing you part one of a conversation with artist and writer Carol Tyler. Her books include Soldier's Heart, Late Bloomer, and The Ephemerata. Carol's work has been featured in the comics anthologies Women's Comics, Twisted Sisters, and Drawing Power, Women's Stories of Sexual Violence, Harassment, and Survival. And you have a couple of exhibitions. Well, one was back in 2021, and it was actually kind of tying in with The Ephemerata. It was an interactive art installation in Cincinnati, and it was called Shaping Grief, Carol Tyler's Morning Mind.
That's right. And what I did was, it was kind of kooky. We have a farm. There was a people that didn't take care of it farm that we got on the cheap just before the pandemic. And Justin and I were supposed to move there because our house here was going to be purchased by the zoo. So in a panic, we got, oh, I had somewhere else, I bought the farm. Well, the farm became my gigantic outdoor studio. I just love it. And when I found the farm, it was like, this is the place I need to express myself about this place at Refill. I needed it. And I could see it and feel it in all the elements of the farm. So what I did for that exhibit was I actually built a bonnet, the scale of which I describe in the book. So it's like, wait, I'm going to build a bonnet. How do I do that?
And this was a tribute to your family's mourning bonnet, right?
That was that mourning bonnet that was on my parcel in Greenville. I actually made it in three-dimensional with plywood and wood and all this kind of stuff. I had to make it and construct it on the front porch of this. Like, it's like, okay, it's got to be that high. Just before, I'll make it as high as, let's see, an 8-foot board to go up here. So turns out also I have construction skills. So I was able to get 2x4s and plywood and everything, and the right tools together. I was out there cutting. And then I had to build it, but I also had to be able to take it apart so I could transport it up to the gallery and then put it back together. And it was built in such a way that you could walk through it. You know, I talk about in the book, the ribs of the bonnet. On the sides, I had places set up where people could take a small piece of paper. I had a stack there, and they could tribute to their loved one and put that there, hang it on the side of the bonnet. So it was there with some of the artwork from the show. But when it came time for the Billy Ireland exhibit, which is up right now, the bonnet was too specific to the book, The Ephemerata, and this was a show about my whole career. So that's why in the center of the exhibit is the ink kettle of inspiration. So again, it was this huge thing that you can walk into, write down what inspires you, and it's filled with all kinds of stuff on the inside, but it's a kettle. Coming out of the spout is steam with ink pen points stuck all over it. Yeah.
Well, this puts me in mind, there are scenes in your books that are almost like stagecraft. You might draw a house where you can see through the wall into a room, like it's a screen, like it's translucent.
How else can you show? Because you look at a house, there's the outside, but you know the inside in your mind. And yet the action is in the inside, but or maybe you're inside and you know the outside. So that's, I love that. That's the thrilling part for me of comics is, how do I make this work where I can take what my brain wants to do and maybe pull it away from language and try to find another way to convey what I'm trying to say. Some people don't know this, but I was illiterate growing up. I couldn't read. I got sent to kindergarten when I was 4. Because my birthday is in November. So when it was time to be in kindergarten, I was immature. Today they would keep me back for another year. And I learned when I taught school, taught first graders, that there's a magic window where language and vocabulary and all that flourishes. And you got to get into that window and teach them about decoding language and phonetics. I didn't have that skill. Because language comes from a different side of the brain than perception. I was extremely tuned into the sensory and the audio nature of life, always looking around, always hearing. But language was hard for me. It turns out that all these skills that I use in comics rely on the things I had to bolster because I couldn't read. And the same thing with writing. I didn't follow any rules because, I mean, I understand noun, verb, adjective, noun, all that. But I also get to find that pliable, and I get to shape it the same way I shape forms.
You know, letters are symbols. Letters are art in some way. I mean, I learned this as a calligrapher. But I'm wondering if just that struggle you had with text, with the written word, was what made you such an effective classroom teacher for first graders, for early language learners, when you were doing that as your rent-paying job?
Yes, because we would sit down to read a book, and I'd think, okay, they're all sitting there. This is a book about somebody at the Empire State Building. These kids are from Laos, Mexico, Cambodia, and where are you from? You don't have books at home. And I'm going to describe the Empire State. They don't know what that is. So they're not going to get the gist of the story. So I always felt like what I had to do was find things that they could, first of all, relate to, because otherwise they wouldn't be able to get in the door. So getting into language, finding the right way. Oh, I was a great teacher. I made everything up for the kids because I knew the challenges. And it turns out, I'm proud of this. I had the best behaved and the highest scoring kids because I used all these methods that worked for me that I had picked up because I could right away tell that they weren't going to get what I was being shipped that I was supposed to do to get them to read. They can barely understand English. How are they going to read a book?
Your Billy Ireland Museum exhibit, Write It Down, Draw It Out, it features plywood installations. And, you know, both you mentioned your late husband, Justin Green. Both you and Justin came from traditions where you build and you fix things yourself. You know, you bring your toolbox, and it's an analog toolbox, just to be clear.
Well, Justin was he was also a calligrapher. He started out as a calligrapher, and he went to Scroll Studios in Chicago. He took classes at the Art Institute. He became a sign painter, of course. He made a magnificent comic.
There's a book, and it goes for a lot of money nowadays, The Sign Game.
Yeah. That book is fantastic. We want to reprint that and all the other stories that he did. And that was done not in full color. We want to do a full color sign game. That's down the road. And we're working on it, but you can only go so far. And that gallery I was talking about, I should say, is Julia's gallery, our daughter. And at that gallery, that's when she and I put together the memorial exhibit for Justin's work. Yes, Justin and I both were very tool oriented because he had to do it for signs and other things. And I grew up around tools, and definitely we both had that physicality in the presence of the work. You know, you look at his work, it's all masterfully drawn, you know, masterfully written.
Speaking of Justin Green, his book back in 1972, Binky Brown Meets the Holy Virgin Mary, mm-hmm. that's considered to be the first graphic memoir. Will Eisner gets a lot of credit for A Contract with God, but Binky Brown came out several years earlier.
Binky Brown, he told about his neurosis. At the time, it was called that.
He eventually became diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, yeah. And your daughter Julia inherited that.
Yes, OCD rocks. It rocked my world. It was my family, 2/3 of my family for years, OCD. My husband had a severe case, untreated, and he found workarounds and ways to try to get through life. He did a pretty good job. My daughter had therapy, so she had much more help in her adolescence than Justin did. There was no such thing for him back in the day. He told me it was like a radio blaring all the time. But still, for me to live with that, there was a lot of accommodation and challenges that I had to make. If you watch the movie, you can hear about that. But in order to function and keep the family going, yeah, I had to do a lot more of the heavy lifting, I'd say, because it just was, oh, just do it. You know, rather than deal with dragging an OCD person through having to do this. Take care of it.
The movie we're talking about, you and your late husband, Justin Green, were the subjects of the documentary film Married to Comics, directed yes. by John Kinhart. And, you know, both the documentary and your comic stories are honest about the long-running marital friction between you and Justin. You had separate but adjoining spaces to work and live in.
Well, we did that to work and live, but that wasn't our private life. You know, that was simply, he didn't like doing dishes right away. And maybe a week later, he would get to something, you know, fight the crud. And I'd say, if you would just rinse it, and then that would start. It was just the bickering of marriage. There was so much that I learned as I went along that if I went back to when we were first married, I never would have done or said that, having learned what I had to learn to live with somebody who was so challenged as Justin was. And so the best way to deal with Justin's OCD was to leave him at it and not meddle, not try to fix. I'll catch you when you're ready, you know. And that's not practical, really, in life. Sometimes I had to just bludgeon him into doing something. But it sharpened and strengthened my focus in a funny way. Because I couldn't say something to him without thinking through first how he would take it and where it would land and what would happen if I went ahead and said something. Because he was a literalist, along with everything else, you know. He had very many things. Brilliant genius, but I had to be measured and cautious. And it wasn't because he was mean. It was because it wouldn't be effective. He was like, you know, you see these people who come in, oh, I'm locked out. And the locksmith comes in and figures out just exactly which little things will turn and open the door. I feel like it was more like that.
I never got to meet Justin, but I have a Justin story. Years before I started this show, I met Art Spiegelman. This was in Chicago. And I asked him about the Daniel Clowes comic where he parodied Art as Gummo Bubbleman. Art said that Daniel Clowes called him later and said he hoped Art wasn't offended. You know, Art wasn't. He knew it was all in good fun. But Art said to me that Justin had also called him and said, hey, do you want me to clobber that guy?
Yeah, I know. Justin was very important in Art Spiegelman's story. Art talks about that. Justin did, and you see about it in the movie. Justin did Binky, and then that kind of nudged Art into doing Miles eventually. So credit is given there, and I appreciate that.
Crumb is also influenced by Binky Dustin. Brown meets the Holy Virgin Mary.
Yes, and holds him in high esteem. So there's no doubt about that part there. Yeah, the movie, John had to select a point of view in order to tell a story. And so the point of view does focus on the troubles, and there were plenty. But there was a whole lot of joy, a whole lot of fun, and a whole lot of mystery still. I keep finding things about Justin, uncovering things that are like, oh, man, that I didn't know. Because when you're dealing with OCD, your plate is full. And so, you know, I just forgive him. It's like he's wrestling with his issues. I need to get back to my projects. I will help if called upon. Who needs help? I'll help you. Take care of this, take care of that, get that work done. That's my life.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today with painter, educator, and award-winning cartoonist Carol Tyler. Her books include Soldier's Heart, Late Bloomer, and The Ephemerata, Shaping the Exquisite Nature of Grief.
And don't forget Fab Four Mania.
And Fab Four Mania. Ah, she's the subject of an exhibition at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum in Columbus, Ohio, called Write It Down and Draw It Out, The Comics Art of Carol Tyler. Carol, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
Oh, gosh. Just Google me.
All right.
My publisher is Fandor Graphics. You can get my books on Amazon and all those places. If you don't like Amazon, go to Fandor Graphics.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. We'll be bringing you part two of this conversation in the very near future. In the meantime, you can find an archived version of this episode later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.